Everybody wants to own their own ship. You know, that's, by the way, one of the worst things we can do. You own a boat, you find out how much money you lose on it.
If the U.S. can't buy a new icebreaker, Congressman Young proposes leasing one instead. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 15th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state limits plans to expand hospital emergency rooms in Anchorage.
There's obviously a need. We can't move forward with nothing. And Providence, they have need for 8 additional rooms right off the bat.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Nothing highlights American disinterest toward the Arctic as much as the tiny inventory of U.S. icebreakers. One heavy-duty ship, one medium, and one down for repair. Alaska leaders and some federal officials say the country can't assert its national interests or see the benefits of increased shipping and resource development in the Arctic without more icebreakers. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, some advocates say now say, why buy when you can lease?
Coast Guard Commandant Paul Zukonf sounds a little embarrassed by the state of the icebreaker fleet.
We have 8 times the GDP, probably about 8.5 right now, of Russia. Russia has a fleet of over 25 ocean-going icebreakers. They're building 6 new nuclear icebreakers. And here we are trying to cobble together and maybe reactivate a 37-year-old icebreaker, because that's the best that we can do.
For years, Alaska's delegation to Congress has pleaded for money to build a new icebreaker, and they've won appropriations of a few million dollars. But the Coast Guard says it needs 6 icebreakers, and a single new ship is projected to cost $1 billion or more, roughly equal to the Coast Guard's entire capital budget. Alaska Congressman Don Young says next week he'll offer a bill with alternative funding.
This is a problem. I've been trying to get an icebreaker. Lisa Murkowski has been trying to get an icebreaker. But the Congress is not about to appropriate $1.4 billion for an icebreaker. So we have to figure out another way to get that money either from the Army, the Navy, and the Coast Guard, just not the Coast Guard, a collective organization together to build us icebreakers.
Young was speaking at an Arctic symposium in Washington. Outside the auditorium, he said the government should seek bids from the private sector to build an icebreaker and lease it to the government, with the expense divvied among several agencies. Young says he knows leasing is not the Coast Guard's top choice.
Everybody wants to own their own ship. You know, that's, by the way, one of the worst things we can do. You own a boat, you find out how much money you lose on it. So if you get somebody that's going to lease it to you and maintains it for you to standard, that's the way I'd go.
Some Coast Guard leaders over the years have questioned whether a leased ship is appropriate for frontline government missions where the Coast Guard is asserting U.S. sovereignty. Admiral Zukonf, the current Coast Guard boss, says the service can't do as much with a leased ship.
First and foremost, you need to have some degree of agility. You may need to operate that platform beyond what it was designed to operate in a given year based on the mission demands that are being placed upon it.
For any lease or buy decision, a house, a car, a ship, a key factor is how long you intend to keep the item. After a certain point, buying has the advantage. Also, Zunkoff says budget rules essentially charge an agency the whole cost of the lease in the first year.
So from a business case, a lease option right now does not provide us an optimal return on investment for a platform that quite honestly we've proven that we can maintain these for 35, 40 plus years.
But as with houses and cars, if you don't have the money and you can't get the money, buying isn't really an option. Senator Lisa Murkowski this week plugged an idea of former Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell. He says the United States could join other countries to provide an icebreaker escort service across the Arctic. As he sees it, With Canada, Finland, China, and maybe Korea, maybe Russia, the U.S. could set up regular transpolar convoys. Treadwell says it requires thinking of the Arctic as a shared business asset, like a jointly owned canal.
Suppose we told ships of the world, meet us at Port Clarence every Wednesday at noon, and there's an icebreaker heading out across to maybe a port in Iceland or a port in Norway, and you might pay a fee, like pay a fee for a canal.
Treadwell's concept couldn't stand in for some of the Coast Guard's government missions, but Murkowski says maybe it makes sense to focus on the commercial service first. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
State Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson is granting Providence Hospital in Anchorage permission to open 8 new emergency room beds. The decision, which was released yesterday, also denies Alaska Regional's plan to build the first freestanding emergency rooms in the state. The commissioner hopes the decision will help discourage inappropriate use of an expensive healthcare option. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Providence Hospital had hoped to build 14 new emergency rooms at its Anchorage campus, designed mostly for pediatric patients. Commissioner Davidson agreed to about half that number. Jared Cosen is executive director of the State Office of Rate Review. He says allowing 8 new emergency rooms in Anchorage will meet the current need, but not exceed it.
There's obviously a need. We can't move forward with nothing. And Providence shows through its kind of trend data and its numbers that they have need for 8 additional rooms right off the bat.
In Alaska, hospitals need approval from the state to build big new projects. The idea is to prevent hospitals from building too many facilities and then passing the cost on to consumers. Cosen's office concluded Anchorage could support 13 new emergency rooms between now and 2022, but then recommended Davidson approve only 10 new rooms for Providence. The state's health department is working hard to reduce emergency room visits and the cost associated with those visits. And Cosen says the commissioner decided adding any extra capacity would work against that goal.
Emergency room visits are expensive. A lot of the cases that present can be handled in a less expensive, appropriate setting, like an urgent care clinic or a primary care office. So the idea that we want to anticipate growth for emergency room services, despite there being an immediate need, we'd rather try our efforts at reform and try and curb that growth.
Alaska Regional Hospital wanted to build 2 freestanding emergency rooms in South Anchorage and Eagle River. The hospital argued all of the city's emergency rooms are currently concentrated in a 2-mile area, and it made sense to expand access to other parts of the city. But freestanding ERs have been criticized for driving up healthcare costs by increasing inappropriate emergency room use. And Cosen says that was a big factor in the decision.
Does it make sense to have a freestanding entities, create access to emergency room services, and for the emergency services that actually do walk through the door, they may not be equipped to meet that demand. So does it make sense to kind of create this access point? And I think based on those and the cost argument, it really doesn't.
Alaska Regional CEO Julie Taylor is disappointed with the state's action. She thinks the health department focused too much on markets where freestanding emergency rooms aren't successful, instead of paying attention to areas where they work well. Taylor says during the public comment period, the hospital had a lot of support from community members in outlying areas of Anchorage.
Eagle River in particular was very vocal, and especially when you look at the distance involved between their community ERs and Glen Highway, the challenges that come with that when there are accidents or weather hazards, it really is a safety issue for patients, and to have access in their own community, I think it's very important.
The hospitals have 30 days to appeal the decision, and both Regional and Providence are considering that option. Although Providence Alaska Chief Executive Dr. Dick Monsager says he's generally happy with the state's action. He says it's too early to say how the hospital will revise its expansion plan to account for adding 8 new rooms instead of 14.
the principle that we are going to have a pediatric emergency care area is we're all committed to that. So will that be all eight? Will it be six of the eight? Will we do six that are really pediatrics and two are swing for adults and kids? I think that remains to be seen as we work it out with the architects and the program leaders together.
Providence says it will take about a year and a half to open its new emergency rooms. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, UAF snags the HAARP Research Facility in Gakona.
It really is pretty exquisite. It's a good catch for the state of Alaska and for the University of Fairbanks to get this excellent facility.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Today, a massive barge docked in Kodiak in its first stop to transport hundreds of tons of marine debris to the Lower 48. Its arrival is part of a bigger project covering coastlines in Alaska and British Columbia with a mission to remove marine debris and head to Seattle to recycle and process it. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
A percentage of marine debris on Alaska shorelines is from the 2011 Japanese earthquake and tsunami. Jana Stewart is the Tsunami Marine Debris Coordinator for Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, one of the organizers of the event, and says it's hard to determine how much of the debris is from that tsunami. However, they've seen things like fishing gear, dock fragments.
Foam that's used in a lot of construction, tanks, household items. As time has gone on, some of the heavier debris has been coming in that's moving in the currents rather than bouncing up driven by the wind. So they've seen a change in the nature of the debris that's come in. For example, they weren't seeing dimensional lumber from Japan until a couple of years after the tsunami, and now they've started to see that.
Stewart says nonprofits and other groups have been collecting marine debris for years, and many of those collection sites are remote, like Gore Point and Montague.
And a lot of those sites, the debris can't be removed even by smaller vessels because the shorelines are rocky. They're high-energy beaches with a lot of surges. So the debris, once it's been collected and stored on the shoreline, for many of these locations, the only practical way and the safest way to get the debris off the shorelines is to get it airlifted onto the barge.
The Japanese government is largely funding the project with $900,000 from the $2.5 million it granted Alaska. Stewart says Japan donated a total of $5 million to coastal states and says she's met with other state recipients at conferences. She says not only did Alaska get hit harder than other states, but it also faces unique challenges.
The story I always tell is when they were doing the presentation on the pickup of this big dock that came in, I think it was in Oregon, they talked about how they had to drive a quarter of a mile on a logging road to get to the beach. And I said, you have a road?
It's an issue that the Kodiak Archipelago can relate to. Tom Pogson is Director of Education, Outreach, and Marine Programs with Island Trails Network, a nonprofit that has been working to remove marine debris from Kodiak shorelines since 2013. Pogson says ITN has accumulated 180,000 pounds of marine debris in its storage yard, and volunteers spent the weekend preparing it for transport. He says ITN started to make plans with other organizations for the debris removal in February, and those plans fell into place over the last couple of weeks.
We've been talking about this for a couple of years, but the specifics of getting the contracts finalized and getting a plan and finding appropriate vessels and getting all of the mechanics of this particular large-scale removal from this large stretch of coastline set up has been very complicated.
And he says that's the nature of the beast.
It's a bit like riding your bike in the dark on a road without any lights. You basically know you're on the road. You can sort of get a feel for where you're going. And you know there's lots of other people that are going there with you, and you just close your eyes and go.
A kickoff event will take place Thursday in Kodiak to celebrate the barge launch and the month-long debris removal along the coast. The public is invited to hear speakers, including the DEC Commissioner, NOAA Marine Debris Program Regional Coordinator, and the Director of Gulf of Alaska Keeper, a nonprofit involved in the removal. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
According to a recent NOAA study, Alaskan shellfish hatcheries risk becoming unsustainable by 2040 because of ocean acidification. Over the last week, we've heard how a hatchery in Oregon is dealing with changes in ocean chemistry and about groundbreaking genetic research on shellfish adaptability. But the big questions still remain. How far-reaching will the effects be, and can we mitigate them before it's too late? KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
Throughout this discussion, there's been an elephant in the room, wild stocks. Do wild coastal shellfish face the same 25-year end date that Alaskan hatcheries do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question right there is, can organisms evolve quickly enough to compensate for that change?
Gretchen Hoffman is a leading scientist in the field of genetic adaptability. She's found that certain strains of organisms do selectively favor the trait of acid tolerance from generation to generation.
You know, if you look into the literature and other systems, you can find examples where rapid evolution has occurred. So the answer for biology and living things is yes. But
the answer for specific breeds of living things is we don't really know yet, and that's a concern for Alaskans who have relied on particular types of clams and other shellfish for many years as a food source. Jeremy Mathis is a NOAA oceanographer who worked on the study at the Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery in Seward.
The measurements that we made in the hatchery does cause some alarm for those natural environments, because it's the same water that we're seeing in the hatchery that's all up and down the coast.
Jeff Hetrick is the owner of Aleutic Pride. Like many local residents, he's noticed a serious decline in shellfish populations in south-central Alaska.
Well, absolutely. I don't think that we're going to lose the wild stocks. We basically lost the wild stocks. They're really hard to come by. It's difficult for us to even get the brood stock to produce in the hatchery. You know, that's a razor clam issue, and people are aware of that on the peninsula, but especially in Lower Cook Inlet and Homer area, little neck clams, butter clams, cockles—they're hard to find. It's been a decline now for the past decade.
Hoffman says some of the urchin divers she works with on the California coast have noticed similar years with very poor harvest numbers. She says there haven't been enough studies yet to make a definite correlation with acidification, but it is something scientists and locals are thinking about.
It's a pretty big concern, you know, because some of the things that we learn about invertebrate biology is that just the simple first beginning step of fertilization is pH sensitive. So right there, if you have a species that has the sperm-egg interaction being affected by acidification, then right off the bat, no matter how many adults you have fewer progeny going forward and therefore really bad recruitment years.
So what we need to do now is take our monitoring systems that we've installed in the hatchery and expand those out into these natural sites, so that we're getting that same level of monitoring, that same level of environmental intelligence, so that that we can answer that question.
NOAA's Pacific Marine Environment Lab in Seattle and the University of Alaska Fairbanks are doing just that. Not only do they plan to expand hatchery research to another site, possibly Ketchikan, they're also partnering for a new study. Wiley Evans is heading out this week with a team of scientists to survey acidification parameters from Dixon Entrance in southern southeast all the way to Kodiak Island.
We're doing measurements both continuously as the ship's moving, from surface seawater flowing through the vessel, sort of in the same way that we are making measurements at Aleutic Pride. And we're also going to be making measurements at specific places where we profile the entire water column from the surface down to the bottom.
Evans says they're hoping to get a more comprehensive picture of current ocean conditions so that they can make more educated decisions on how to deal with acidification in the future. A future that could look much worse than today, says Hoffman.
I think it's a pretty big problem if you stand back and look at it for what it is.
It is a complex problem with regional factors that exacerbate it. In places like Alaska, for example, carbon emissions speed up CO2-rich glacial melt. In places like Washington, Oregon, and California that are subject to seasonal upwelling, the newer oxygen-rich water has more CO2 to begin with now, so it can't as efficiently counteract the deeper, older CO2-rich water that comes to the surface. On top of that, scientists have estimated that the water coming up is 30 to 50 years old. Imagine that many years from now, when today's water is what lies beneath the surface.
We can't get complacent and say, well, we've done enough. It's time to move on to the next crisis. This is something that we have to keep right at the forefront and make sure that people understand that while we've learned a lot in the past few years, we've still got a long way to go in terms of understanding the long-term implications of ocean acidification.
Mathis says that is why it's crucial to do this work now, to salvage and protect what we can of the marine ecosystem for 2, 10, or 25 years down the line. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The Alaska Department of Education is interested in contracting with 3 experienced Alaskan educators to help underperforming schools improve instruction and student performance. Apply by July 23rd. Inquire at the Department of Education for information. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
The State Department of Transportation is moving forward with its environmental review of the Juneau Access Project. The governor's state budget director wrote a memo last week giving the department the go-ahead to finish the document that lays out the state's case for where the road should or shouldn't be built. Last December, the governor ordered DOT to stop all discretionary spending, not incur new expenses, or change existing contracts. Now the administration is allowing DOT to spend up to $900,000 of general fund money and associated federal funds to finish the supplemental environmental impact statement. DOT spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says part of completing the environmental review is responding to public comment.
Last fall, we held a public comment period, and we received about 44,000 comments. Of those comments, about 2,400 of those are unique in a way that are going to require some additional work.
DOT has laid out 8 alternatives for improving access to Juneau. Its preferred alternative involves extending Juneau's highway system about 50 miles north to a new ferry terminal on Lynn Canal. From there, shuttle ships would complete the link to Haines and Skagway. The other alternatives include another road option, ferry options, or no action. After completing the environmental review, the state will submit its final preferred alternative to the Federal Highway Administration. Woodrow expects it to support the state's choice. In the memo, Budget Director Pat Pitney wrote that reaching the milestone ensures the state won't have to repay nearly $27 million in federal investments. Then DOT Commissioner Pat Kemp had raised the issue around the new year and was asked to resign. Pitney also wrote the Fed's action is expected in January. Woodrow says it could take longer.
We did have to shut down some of the progress on moving forward with the EIS. So therefore, we're right now is what we call ramping up stage, getting the contractors back on, deciding what the next logical steps are with moving forward with the EIS. And so we're definitely shooting for that in January 2016, but it's too early to tell if that's a deadline that we can meet with the work that needs to be done.
So far, Woodrow says about $41 million has been spent studying the Juneau Access Project. The University of Alaska Fairbanks will take ownership of GACONA's high-frequency active auroral program, best known as HAARP. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
After 2 bumpy years waiting for the U.S. Air Force to decide what to do with HAARP, UAF has won its bid to take over the facility for research purposes. About a year ago, UAF, with the support of scientists around the globe, managed to delay the Air Force's plan to close and demolish the HAARP compound. UAF spokeswoman Marmion Grimes says UAF will take ownership of the $200 million facility next month.
It's a transfer, and next month the facilities and equipment will formally transfer from the military to the university. And then we have 2 years to work with the Air Force to come together on an agreement to transfer land.
The university must still negotiate with the military for 1,500 acres of land out of the 5,500 acres the Air Force owns in Gakona. The university system is loaning UAF $2 million to get the facility back into operation. Grimes says a plan is in place to raise money to cover the loan and costs associated with operations.
Scientists would pay to use the facility for their research projects, and then that would support operations. And that's a common model for the university and research community.
Bob McCoy, who heads UAF's Geophysical Institute, has been instrumental in persuading the Air Force to give HAARP to the university.
But in the last decade or so, the Navy, the Air Force, and DARPA all chipped in $40 to $50 million each, and they expanded it, increased the power, and made improvements. It really is pretty exquisite. It's a good catch for the state of Alaska and for the University of Fairbanks to get this excellent facility. And both the chancellor and the president of the university really saw that and were eager to have this added to our portfolio here.
HAARP is one of only three similar facilities in the world. Research into the Earth's ionosphere was the primary job at HAARP when the Air Force operated it. But in June of 2013, the military announced that research was coming to an end and made known its intention to shutter HAARP. Last July, HAARP was saved the day before bulldozers were ordered to move in. Grimes says scientists rallied to put pressure on the Air Force to scrap the demolition plan. UAF faculty and graduate students have used HAARP for research over the past few years, and now the university plans to expand programs there. Bob McCoy says HAARP turns the ionosphere into a laboratory.
There's a whole bunch of applications. The nice thing is you can the ionosphere, at least 30 kilometers of it, becomes a laboratory, and for a few minutes you can actually do experiments and see what happens.
HAARP has been beaming radio waves into the atmosphere since 1997 in ongoing efforts to understand the ionosphere, which has a strong influence on satellite communications. But its mission is often misunderstood and has given rise to speculation that its work is linked to top secret military research. The facility has inspired at least one book, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, authored by Nick Begich. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
The Alaska Marine Conservation Council is working to protect Alaska's oceans ecosystems and promote thriving coastal communities. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.